Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection, Tuesday, March 8th. We got a pretty full agenda today, so the order of bills coming forward are not exactly going to go according to the agenda. I am going to open up a hearing first on House Bill 2631, and then I'm going to close that hearing and bring it back up later in the agenda for other testimony. Coming up second, we will do House Bill 3360, then we'll do 3412 and 3415 simultaneously, and last we will do House Bill 3000, time allowing, which I think we will have time. So with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2631 and call Representative Schaffler to the dais, podium, whatever that seat down there is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative from House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland. Thank you for your flexibility. I have a pie in the oven and I got to run. So, House Bill 2631, it came to my attention just, I don't know, during the interim that apparently you can, in a contractor's bid, a public contractor contract, you can put in an in-kind contribution or donation to the contracting agency, and I just think that isn't right. I think it's a kickback. That doesn't smell right, good. It doesn't pass the fish test. I think we should get rid of that part of contracting and bidding, and that's all I come here to say. There's some really smart people behind me that are going to come and testify on its behalf. I'd be happy to answer any questions within my limited power and ability if you have any, but other than that, that's what I wanted to say. It's not a way to contract. It's not a way to bid. It's wrong. We should get rid of their ability to do that.
Questions from the committee for Representative Schaffler? So your opportunity. Thank you, Representative,
thank you,
for bringing it forward. I'm sure we'll have more discussion on it later.
Thank you very much. Good work.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2631 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3360. And I'd like to bring Representative Wisnant forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you.
Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
This is Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. And for our citizens in the audience today, that we planned to have this as an all-public contracting day, but we had to carry this bill over from the last session. So I thank the chair for working with me and we're getting this scheduled and get it out of the way and on its way to passing, I hope. It's a simple bill. Everyone has a copy of it. House Bill 360 is relating to vacant positions in state agencies. Okay, to wake you up this morning, if you haven't had your coffee, let me get your attention right away. This bill could return $225 million from state agency vacant positions to the general fund to a fund of essential services like education, public safety, and other special needs. That's correct, $225 million. Since I entered the legislature, I've been concerned about how the legislature reviews agency budgets. In the Ways and Means process, agencies only identify the total FTEs they need to perform their mission. Over my five terms and four sessions, I've learned that agencies have vacant positions. That's a fact. It's a fact that some positions remain vacant for an extended period of time. I can't prove this. I hear and I suspect that agencies may use funding for these vacant positions for operational expenses and to satisfy agency reductions. Oregon's not unique in this. A Florida newspaper article titled, "Floridians Pay for Vacant State Jobs." Quote, "Florida's state government workforce now includes about 5,500 positions that have been vacant for at least a month. Jobs that Floridian people pay to keep open even as legislators hit them with billions in fees and tax increases. The empty jobs add up to $150 million in annual salary. based upon minimum starting wage for each job. The article pointed out that if the jobs are vacant, state agencies can use the money for their workmen's salaries or to plug holes in their budget. The American Legislative Exchange Council, the state budget reform toolkit report stated, typically hundreds of unfilled positions in state government exist on paper. If a position remains open for more than 6 months, wouldn't you assume the agency can do the work without an employee in that position? By eliminating all positions that have gone unfilled for 6 months, the state can cut budget payrolls in areas not critical to state safety or the basic operation of state government. Committee members, I provided you a copy of the Florida News article, a copy of the long-term vacancy summary statistics, a 1 January 2011 agency report on vacant positions, and a copy of the allotment reduction report. If you look at the long-term six-month vacancy summary, which I think Jan provided you, this is required and prepared by the budget and management in accordance of ORS 291.263. And if you look down the far right-hand corner, 3,014 vacant positions that have been vacant for 6 months or longer. This is the report. It was submitted by agencies. Let's assume the total personnel cost for a position is $50,000, which LFO believes is a conservative estimate. With 3,000 long-term vacant positions, that's $150 million per year, $300 million for a biennium. And then LFO pointed out that when we pass this bill this session, we'll have to take the six-month waiting period off, so it's only $225 million, not $300 million. I understand that this is not new money. I haven't gone out and discovered a gold mine. But it's providing $300 million for the two-year budget in the out years, if you put the 6 months back in, to fund essential services not used by an agency for purposes that they requested from the legislature that didn't fill those positions. Then you can see from the January 31st, 2011 report. And this is the report that the Oregonian I'll talk about in a minute. This is where they came up with the 4,000 vacant positions. If you look at that report, we have 529 positions vacant for 12 months or longer. Finally, this LFO report, which has the allotment reduction program, appears to confirm that agencies do address their allotment reductions with 479.68 vacant positions. Now, this report, you have to understand, there's a number of vacancies is the positions that were eliminated, but when you figure out that this was for months, not for 2 years, that's where you come up with the FTE total. It's based upon the months left when they made this reduction. When I submitted the bill, LFO Director Ken Rocco and Deputy Darren Hill provided me some good suggestions, which I've accepted, and you have the amendment for these changes. I'll answer those questions if you have any questions, but they clarified who can take the money away and who can take the positions away, and they also asked for a copy of this report. Colleagues, I submit we must stop the agency practice and dedicate our limited and viable revenue to real services for our citizens, not for slush funds or as a resource for reductions. This was my prepared testimony for Thursday. Since then, there's been a little press coverage about this subject. The Oregonian, as I said, reported 4,475 jobs were paid for and left empty. The Register Guard stated state records indicate that Oregon government had 4,475 vacant positions. And as I said, both of these reports are correct, but they included all vacant positions from the 131-2011 report. And my testimony is only considering those positions that are vacant for 6 months or longer, which the bill addresses. In the Oregonian March 3rd article, Ways and Means co-chair Senator Richard Devlin says he expects a get-tough position on state vacancies this year. We'll be looking at every position that's been vacant for any period of time. Brother Governor Kitzhaber says he's tuned into the issue and is interested in the bill. The Eugene Register Guard, March the 5th editorial, commented, "It's pretty good bet that any private company with an annual budget of over $7 billion would fire any accountant who allowed what an Oregonian reporter called phantom workers to make up 11% of the company's total workforce. The Oregonian editorial titled Phantom Jobs in a Broken Budget and subtitled The Legislature Needs to Retool How It Spends and Accounts for Our Money. It reports, the governor should work in concert with the legislature and others who quite reasonably demand that the budget process make sense and carry with it the guarantee we're spending only what it takes to meet real needs. Friends, that's what this bill is all about, and it needs to pass. Thank you very much, and I'm available for questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Conger.
Representative Wisnett, could you just describe the amendment briefly? Thanks. I don't seem to have a copy here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Conger, if you look at the bill, you have a copy of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
On line 6, we're deleting full-time equivalent. Policy would apply to all positions, part-time. If we have it in there full-time, you would not address full-time or partial positions. On line 12, we're replacing the state agency with the Department of Administrative Services. On line 13, replacing state agencies with Department of Administrative Services. In line 3, we're adding legislative fiscal office to the list of people receiving the report. LFO was concerned about a statement in line 9 about valid reasons for retaining the position, but that's important. This bill, if the agency justifies it, they don't lose it. That's all they got to do is justify they're keeping it. And because they were concerned about seasonal workers. We do have seasonal workers, and people budget for that.
Follow up.
For those of us who have not had the experience of serving on Ways and Means, could you just briefly describe how the staffing discussions go? I heard in your testimony that the agencies will come and explain to Ways and Means how many positions they're planning, in their budget. I mean, is there some kind of deeper analysis of the need or anything in the Ways and Means process?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question, Representative Conger. I was going to try to get a copy of this. I grabbed a work page from one of the Representative Garrard this morning. It's not a big amount. It's the Board of Licensed Social Workers. But when the Ways and Means process is approved, they look at the total FTEs and the money. And a check is issued for the amount of money, which includes those FTEs' complete salary and benefits. So if they take that money, the point of the bill is, and leave a vacant position, they have extra money. They don't have to give that money back. They're using it for other needs or to raise, sometimes to satisfy cuts, sometimes to satisfy step increases or pay raises for the employees they have. There is data that our staffs do not have time to really go in and look. They give you, there's more data out there, just like these reports. I'd never seen these reports until about a week ago before this bill was to be introduced. So there's data out there. But what this bill's doing is putting the burden back on the directors of these departments and saying, okay, if you've got these positions, justify it. If you can't justify it, we're going to move it to another agency that needs a position, and that money goes with it. It's not just blank money. You told us you're going to do this mission, and to do this mission, you need 4 people. And you leave it open for a year? You didn't need 4 people to do this job. There's other agencies that need that worse. So that's all the bill's doing.
Mr. Chair.
Other states are looking at it too, and Representative Jensen joined me on this bill. He had a bill that was going to lose it after 3, or he was saying 3 months, and I went 6 months. So,
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. One of the concerns that I would probably anticipate potentially. We would start hiring people that maybe aren't qualified to fill positions out of fear of losing them. Can you explain how you've set this bill up to make sure that that wouldn't be a issue of rushing to fill positions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Cameron. Our job is to balance the budget, a responsible budget. We have to have correct data. The departments are not giving us good data. That's a problem. There was a quote in the paper, shouldn't micromanage. This is not micromanaging committee members to look at this level. We're not down in the trenches managing these companies. I don't think you're rushing with the population we have unemployed now, Representative Cameron. I think there's plenty of qualified people out there that would love to have these vacant jobs, and I don't understand why anyone would say, hey, if you need that job, I'm available, I'll go for it. Now, let me tell you, committee members, I've already been told that good idea, it may work, but let me tell you, there's people out there that will game the system. There's people out, friends, you can game anything. You know, tax deductions or whatever. You know, one expert in this building says, Representative, what they're going to do is they're going to take a filled position person and move him over to the vacant position every 3 months or something. They can do that. If that's what our leaders are doing, then we've got problems at the top of our state government, at the governorship and the department heads. Yeah, you can game it. You can fill it at 5 months and not 6 months. If this is just pointing out, I think, an area that needs to be tightened up. I think the governor addressed that in his comment to the Oregonian. I think that Senator Devlin addressed it. We're the first point. We need to start the process. It's putting a little bit of control and oversight out there. We're not saying you're going to lose all these positions. We're saying if you've got it vacant, justify it. There may be a need over here or somewhere else for that money.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So part of what I'm wanting to understand, and I think, you know, you're like me, it's possible to understand fully, you know, sort of why it happens, right? And I heard, excuse me, I heard a couple of possible answers. One is the agencies use it as a buffer. Well, if there's little cuts or something happens, then we have at least these vacant positions. Two, as I think I heard you say, if we miss our guess on some other operations expenses, right, it's like, well, we thought in order to accomplish our mission, we need to do this and biannual budgeting, and we needed three people. What we actually needed was two people and a goat, or two people in a building, or two people and, you know, a goat. I thought the goat thing would be funnier. If we do this, and then they don't have the buffer, and they don't have the ability to juggle to the other operations, is there some other changes in our budgeting that we need to do to, you know, accomplish those interests, right? Because it does, I mean, maybe, unless all we think it is a lack of discipline, all we think it is, well, they're just actually just not very good, but doing a very good job budgeting, they're not very specific, they're not doing a good enough job, maybe that's it. If it's not just that, is there any other budgeting reforms we need to do alongside this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, thank you for the question. I didn't laugh at your goat. In Central Oregon, we hire a lot of goats to go out and remove our noxious weeds, and that's...
It's a good point you raise. That's a good point. That's probably what was going on with everybody. It was very funny. Everybody was thinking about the noxious weeds. That's what's going on.
My experience in three legislative sessions is there's obviously a lot of things better we could do in the budgeting review, but there is money for the situation you described. That's what the e-board is about, and that's what we should have it for. It's a very complicated process. We're here for a short period working in the Ways and Means and trying to dig into these things. And you know, I don't think our job is to be a micromanage the departments and the agencies. We're supposed to bid at 3,000 feet or 10,000 feet and look at what they're giving us. But to the bottom line of your question, yes, this is an area that we need to look at in our budgeting process. And I think that's what the governor and Senator Devlin are supporting me in, that we need to, this is an area we're going to tighten it up. We're just going to put another management tool in there. It's not a lot of, you know, asking them to give us reports. It seems like the report data is out there. Mr. Chair, for the committee members, if you look at the long-term vacancy summary report, you know, you look at the top, and there's different categories, you know, that they're going to, here's some abolished. They abolished 93, where they used that to fulfill the cut or whatever. Then you got, they're in the process of filling it. Then you have seasonal workers, recruiting difficulties, you know. So there's categories there, but I still think the totals are too high at the end of the line for 12 months. I just... Representative Cameron's comment that they're, you know, going to rush to get the best. I think there's plenty of best people out there unemployed right now that could fill the vacancies if you need it.
So, Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one example you gave kind of caught my attention. the board of something or other.
Yeah.
So they, I assume, are paying licensing fees as members of that industry to this board on their own, and then it's made up of a board of their peers. And my just question is, if it's not general fund and it's, you know, licensing fees and it's made up of the people who pay them supervising it, I'm just sort of curious why they wouldn't want to do it since it's their own money. And so I'm wondering if maybe we ought to be targeting general fund or at least hear from someone who comes from a licensing fee but type of place about why they would let their own money just sit there, given that's not tax money, it's, you know, it's their own fees.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quinn, I grabbed this morning. It was not a good example to bring. You know, you want to look at the big agencies and the, right, and the things like that. Still, as you know, those agencies, we do approve, the Ways and Means process approves their positions and them to use the money, because, you know, actually it's fees are passed on. It's a consumer expense that gets passed on. So that was not a good example. They have four FTEs. So that was not a... But my point I wanted to make to you is when the Ways and Means process, this is what you see when you're approving the budget. The agency tells you, I need this many people to do this job, and this is what it's going to cost. And that's what the Ways and Means process is looking at now.
Just one follow-up real quick. So, yeah, in this particular example, I know it's not the ideal one, but of a fee-funded place, they still would just make a report, and if they've got their own reason for why they're doing this, then they just state that to whose satisfaction, the director of DASA's satisfaction, that no, they're, you know, we, for some reason, we're doing something different. We just upped our fees, and we aren't quite ready to hire because we're still blah, blah, blah. And if the director of DASA is okay, then they can leave it vacant until they're ready to hire.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, the report is also going to the President of the Senate, mm-hmm, to the Speaker of the House, to the Assembly, and to LFO. So now we've got other people looking at what's going on here. Your agency budgets, I'm not 100% sure, but I think the small licenses like this that depend on fees, they don't have that many vacancies. I'm looking real fast at the report. This is not the ones that are able to do that, because there's really small, there's some agencies that are 100 people, but most of them are small numbers. If they're not keeping a vacant position, they're in here actually arguing every time for more FTEs to do their job, because they do then raise their budget fees and can do that. So again, I think what this is doing, the data's there, and now we've got the Senate, the House, the members, and LFO getting this data and saying, well, let's look at that. Mm-hmm. So it's just a management tool for the legislature leaders.
So, Representative Wynn, I do have a couple of thoughts and want to push back just a little bit on this concept. But I do appreciate the bringing this forward, you know, having to look at vacant positions. But it seems to me that, you know, we have two different pieces of this. We have a budget that we do ahead of time. Just like if I was, you know, running my household budget, I'd look out and say, here's my expenses, I need to budget for this, this, and this. And so we're budgeting out 2 years, and you know, our state agencies are looking out there, and they're going, okay, this is what we're projecting, this is what our mission is, and actually the legislature approves that in the Ways and Means process up front. And as time goes by, you know, things happen, or perhaps, you know, we're looking out forward and saying, oh, you know, if I was running a business, or I'm getting laid off next week, or the state's looking at their revenue forecast declining, and it seems like it would be actually fiscally prudent for state agency to say, look, our budget's going down. We shouldn't be putting a bunch of money into hiring a bunch of people. We're going to have to turn around and lay them off. And so at the end of the month, or the end of the biennium, you know, we have to reconcile that and actually pay our expenses. And I asked LFO some questions about this too, and these agencies actually don't have the money for these FTEs. They don't have a bank account or a slush fund that they're holding on to. That money sits in the general fund until it's appropriated for that position. And so that the money may be appropriated through the budget.
Mr. Chair, your question is going a long time. I can't remember all your questions.
Well, I'm making a statement.
That's not true. The agency can go back.
I have the gavel here.
So let me finish, and then I'll let you respond.
You're making a statement.
Well, I am making a statement. This is a committee hearing, and I'm making a statement. So, but the issue is you're talking about a budget that's going forward, and this phantom worker idea that the state agency has a bunch of money in a slush fund that they're holding on to, you know, seems like a phantom issue to me, because we sort of encourage our state agencies not to spend money when we see our income's not going to be able to pay for it at the end of the month. And so it seems like this is actually fiscally prudent for them not to fill those positions, because they're not going to have the money. The state's not going to have the money. And so when the legislature comes back in and sweeps that money at the end of the biennium, if there's money, it rolls back over into the general, it stays in the general fund, and it helps pay the next biennium. I'm just sort of having trouble seeing how this is saving the state any money, because really that money's all in the general fund to start with, and the Ways and Means Committee, you know, authorizes that money to be spent. And for every particular issue, you know, it just seems like this is really prudent management not to fill positions, and that money stays in the general fund, and as it then comes back to the legislature to appropriate it where it sees fit. And so I just, you know, I understand your issue that if there's a lot of money out there, maybe we could spend it better other places, but I think that's what our subcommittees and Ways and Means do, and that's what our Ways and Means process does do on this. And so I, you know, I'm not totally disagreeing with you, but I think that, you know, we're confusing a budget that's based on a forecast with the actual expenses at the end of the biennium, and reconciling our actual money spent. And it's not that we're spending money on phantom vacant FTEs. There's no money spent on that, and those agencies don't control that money. It rests in the general fund and has to be used for their mission that the Ways and Means process has approved. So I just, you know, that's my statement. Now you can respond to me.
I guess I can testify when you submit that bill.
No, there's no bill. I mean,
the bill I have is simple. It speaks for itself. I disagree completely with it. There's money being held aside by agencies for vacant positions that they're not using. The Ways and Means process, has the chair sat on the Ways and Means process before, committee?
No, I have not.
Okay. It's a very fast, complicated system that you're not able to go in there. This bill asks for a simple report. The agencies tell me how many vacant positions you have and justify why they've been vacant for 6 months. If that's overmanaging, then accepted that fact. I think that is not overmanaging.
I'm not disagreeing with that, Representative Wisden. I'm just disagreeing with the portrayal that these agencies have vacant FTEs that they have money set aside in a slush fund for, and are collecting money that they hold on to. And really that money sits in the general fund until it's appropriated for a filled position. And they have to account for every dollar they spend to the Ways and Means process.
Mr. Chair, if you look at the handout I gave you, agencies used vacant positions to fill their reductions.
The Ways and Means process cuts their budgets. The government governor comes in and cuts the budget, and certainly if they have an allotted use for FTEs, and they've been going, our revenue is going down, we better not fill these because we're gonna get cut, and then we just have to turn around and lay them off. It seems like it's fiscally prudent to keep those positions vacant in that sort of situation, is all I'm saying. So, you know, I don't know. I just think it's a little bit of a phantom issue, and we'll certainly keep pursuing this. And you know, there might be some merit to sending this to Ways and Means and holding those vacant positions accountable every 6 months. But as I see it, as that revenue forecast is looming out there, a state agency would be prudent in not filling those positions. And they're going to have to reduce services because we don't have the money.
Mr. Chair, they based their budget. Their budget was based upon those vacant positions. And 10%, missing by 10%, I submit to you, is not a good manager.
Granted, but they have, and that may be an issue, but all the same, we still have, this is all based on a budget forecast that the legislature does, the Ways and Means process does, and they authorize that budget. And so if the revenue forecast is going down, they need to adjust through the process, and so that we don't overspend. And at the end of the year, we rebalance our budget with a bill and make sure our books balance, so every dollar is accounted for at the end of the month when we actually pay the bills.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Are we going to get testimony from agencies today so we can ask them these same sort of questions?
I don't know that there's agencies signed up to speak, but I'm certainly expect that we will.
I would sure love to hear from DAS about this.
Yeah, I'm certainly. I think we're going to bring this bill back and for another conversation, I think, and look forward to doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think there's other areas that I understand there's a bill that I was thinking of dropping, but another bill looking at the span of management, layers of management, and those are things in this economy that we need to look at. The private industry is doing it, and it's time for the state government to do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Do you have a question for Representative Wisnett? Oh, right. We're not done with the Representative Smith.
This part is just so fun. You guys going back and forth, it's really great. I want to prolong it. I hate it when mommy and daddy fight.
I can't help anybody to go past jokes.
I did catch a question that I now have from this interchange. That was, if in the bill, which is dedicated nobly towards fiscal responsibility and saving money, would we actually be encouraging the spending of money, the hiring of positions that maybe otherwise could be left in an ending fund balance, might be saved money rather than extra spent money by hiring additional people? And I don't know if you have a response to that, you know, to that question, but it did occur to me.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, thank you for not bringing animals into the play. I tell you my example. I've been advised by, you know, longtime staff here that you can game the system. But remember, we're spending every penny we get. We're coming back and asking the people for more taxes, and we're asking them for things that we're spending. So we're not saving this money. That's where I think the chair and I would disagree, that I think that money's being spent. If you look at our final budgets and how much is it, $3.5 billion or is it $1.5 billion? We're short. So they didn't save that money, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And let me just say, and we talked about this in the hall, and we can, some of the questions I'll have are how it relates to budgeting as we go forward, how it relates to budgeting generally, how it relates to ending fund balances and savings, and, you know, rainy day fund, et cetera, how it relates to, and what do we need to do to reward and encourage saving, as distinct from rewarding and encouraging not saving, right? And we've heard from, I think there's sort of bipartisan concern that we give agencies incentive to spend every last dime rather than having anything left over. And so that's sort of, you know, related. And then when we hear from agencies, it'd be valuable to hear how often we're spending that money, what we're spending it on. You know, we're not burning it. We're spending it on something. And is that, what do we need to do with our budgeting process to make sure, you know, we're doing that right? So those are my remaining questions. You don't have to answer them all now, but we can talk going forward. It sounds like something we need to get to the, you know, at least be thinking about getting to the bottom of.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. I think it's good management practice. I think it's something the state legislature should be responsible for. And remember, we're not taking it away. We're saying justify why you're doing this. We're not just cleaning the position off. We're just asking, why has it been vacant for 6 months? Why has it been vacant for a year? If you got a reason, then it's not coming away.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a great bill. And I'll tell you why it's a good bill, because it's a bill with integrity. And that's what this is about. This is about, for example, I just want to look at the Oregon State Police here on the report you gave us. And it has 114 vacancies. And I am sure that if the superintendent was here today, he could tell us why he has a plan for those vacancies, especially when we're talking about hiring high-quality troopers that patrol our roads, and we want the right people there. So, you know, I think that's what we're asking for here, or what you're asking for is just come and explain. I don't know how hard it was for you to get this report, Representative, but this is something you're asking for, is just come up. If you've got 112 vacancies in your agency, give us a plan as to how you're going to use those positions. I think that's all you're asking for here. And I really appreciate your bringing this bill forward with some integrity in our budgeting process. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, thank you for that. That's all it is. It's not a witch hunt. I'm not after direct heads. Because colleagues, I think that what's happened is this has become common practice. But it's got to stop.
Representative Wisnant, I appreciate you bringing it forward, too, and I hope that our Ways and Means process is looking at these issues as well. And it seems to me that they are. They've indicated to me that they look at these vacant positions and that they're actually not spending money on phantom workers, that money still's in the general fund. And so you know, at the end of the day, we're not spending that money foolishly. Certainly it impacts our budgeting process as we go along, and that's what Ways and Means is hopefully is trying to figure out. But I do appreciate you bringing it forward, and we'll continue to have a conversation about this, I'm sure, and I look forward to working a little bit more on this bill with you. And I do note that I got a note, one other person was signed up to testify, Brian DeLashmet.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet. I represent the Oregon State Police Officers Association, the troopers. At the risk of stepping in the middle of it after that exchange.
Oh, why not?
The OSPOA does not have a position on this bill, but we were watching it. And the one thing, and I'm glad Representative Cameron brought up the issue of OSP, because the OSP vacancies, as long as it's a matter of just reporting and somebody saying, yeah, we understand, we instructed you to keep those vacancies, I don't think we have a problem. But obviously, the concern that we have is that as things change, and right now we have gas prices going up very substantially, historically, OSP has had to hold a vacancy or two because of changing gas prices, and they use that money, and it's not in really a slush fund, but they do come back and report to the Ways and Means Committee. But the vacancies that they have right now, the 49 were instructed by the legislature to be held, and it was their allotment cuts. So I don't want anybody in the committee or in the audience or anyone out in video land to not understand that the vacancies that they have right now were not at the specific instructions of the legislature itself during February and the emergency board process. And they do not use them then for other purposes. It's specifically for the allotment cuts. Thank you.
So, Mr. DeLashmet, so what you're telling us is you're holding on to those vacancy cuts or vacancy positions because the legislature is trying to balance, aim at having a balanced budget with your agency at the end of the year.
Mr. Co-Chair, I guess I take a slightly different view of the monies in the general fund than you've stated. The money is not in the general fund. It was a shortage of money. And so the Ways and Means process and the emergency board has instructed them not to hire those positions.
Right, okay.
So it's not that the money's there being held for other purposes. It's there is no money. You have to hold these vacancies. And you're all well aware that we have made this push for 139 additional troopers to get us to 24/7. Well, I'm telling you right now, there's 49 troopers short. And actually, we've got 20 additional vacancies because of in the recent few weeks, because of all the PERS bills and everything else, there are people retiring. So we have some pretty substantial vacancies in OSP. At the same time, you have DPSST, whose class sizes have been and class numbers have been reduced, and we can't get those folks into classes to fill those vacancies. So there are very legitimate reasons why there's vacancies, whether it's instructions from the legislature not to fill the positions, or they can't fill them because of DPSST.
So it's a reflection that our revenue and the actual revenues coming in are short, so that money isn't there to spend on those positions that we previously authorized because the economy and our revenue collections are down.
Exactly, and I want to again make it very clear, we don't have a position in opposition to this bill. If it's a reporting requirement to justify, that's fine. But I just wanted to bring it up to everybody in this committee, and I bring it up as much as I can about 24/7, the expectation, 139 being hired, and then I see a number that shows 49 or 50 vacancies on a list of all the vacancies in all the departments, and it was at the legislature's instructions that they don't hire those folks.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to have to move on at this point because we have a lot of people signed up to testify on other bills I need to get to, and we'll revisit it. And for the record, I don't know that I'm opposed to this bill either. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3360 and opening public hearing on House Bill 3412 and a public hearing on House Bill 3415. Jan, can you give us a description of those two bills, please?
House Bill 3412, it prohibits a contracting agency from using an alternative contracting method to award a public improvement contract in which a single contractor provides both the general contractor and the construction manager services unless the contract is for $5 million or more. It requires that findings for exemptions from the competitive bidding requirements must be made with respect to a specific public improvement contracts or specific class of public improvement contracts. Prohibits a contracting agency from making findings unless specific conditions are met and declares an emergency. House Bill 3415 requires a contracting agency that conducts a procurement for a public improvement to pay a fee equal to 0.1% of the contract price to the Office of the Secretary of State. It requires the Secretary to use the money to conduct financial, compliance, and performance audits of randomly selected public improvement contracts. Requires the Secretary to publish the report of each audit on the Secretary's website and on the Oregon Transparency website.
Thank you. And if I could get my hands on the sign-up sheet so I can see who wants to testify. I have a lot of people signed up on both these bills, so as I call you up, you'll testify on both bills. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So I'm going to have to probably limit you to 3 minutes or so of testimony as well. So first up, I'm going to have Jerry Valencia and Laura Alexander. Good morning, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, and if you have written testimony, it would be good to turn that in but not read it to us, and just sort of summarize your testimony to try to get as much testimony in as we can, so I appreciate that.
Thank you. My name is Laura Alexander, and I've been in public instruction for 7 years. It's taken me 7 years to be able to get to this point. I've been writing the government and talking to the public agencies about public contracting and alternative public contracting. When we're involved with public construction, which is the primary source of the income of Robert Gray Partners, general contractor, they depend on being able to bid and work on those projects. Ever since 2002, Oregon State Legislature passed Senate Bill 437, which allowed Oregon University System to eliminate their public construction projects from the bidding process. In 2005, 50% of the public construction projects were no bid. And at the beginning of our economic crisis, almost 100% of the public construction projects were no bid. That wasn't that very long ago. And right now, what we're looking at is the demise of the majority of the public, the construction companies that work on these projects, the general contractors that normally bid and work on these projects. The majority of them are no longer able to get to the stage of actually bidding or working, because the prerequisite at this time is that they have to have CMGC, alternative contracting, on the resume. And the way that the proposals are written, it says you must have X amount of CMGC projects within a certain time period. If you don't have that in any given year, within the previous 5 years, you no longer qualify to bid and work on public construction projects. Your bill, 3412, mentions a $5 million mark. That should be raised to $15 million. Because many of the projects are around $7 million to $9 million. $5 million is too low. I'm asking you to raise that and to pass 3412 and its coordinating bill as well. I'm also asking you to consider Senate Bill 581, which allows a arm of the Oregon Audits Division to oversee these public contracts, because what's happened since the passing of 437 is our public contracting has become corrupt and monopolized. Thank you.
Jerry Valencia. Or did you want to speak to him?
Oh.
Go ahead.
Jerry Valencia, Eugene, Oregon, also a subcontractor and a small GC, general contractor. I'm here in support of Paul Hovey's bill of 3412, and I, too, believe that the threshold of $5 million is too low. The reason that I'm here is to shed light on the economic surplus of money that's being spent on the CMGC process, because in today's economy, when the CMGC first came out in 2003 and was introduced in 1997, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2008, we had a surplus of contracts out there. Now that we're in a recession, the CMGC process doesn't work as well. And what happens is we actually, through the CMGC process, create what's called a GMP, a guaranteed maximum price, to all these public contracting agencies, which is actually costing the Oregon taxpayers a lot more money. In 2008, Beaverton did a study which compared the CMGC process to the design, bid, build, which is what OSR 279 is all about, the low responsive bidder, and it found that these two exact projects were actually done hand-in-hand, exactly the same, and found that the CMGC process in 2008 actually cost 11% more. What's happening is that in a recession, the state of Oregon knows right now they're saving on an average of 30% per project, and what's going on with the CMGC is it's limiting the opportunities for the other 42,000 registered CCB contractor board contractors in Oregon to be having the opportunity to be bidding on these public contracting agencies, because every contracting agency at this point in time seems to be reaching out to these relational contracts, which is the CMGC, because they feel that they got a lot more trust and buddy building in their industry. The fact of the matter is that Oregon is set up to be more of a transactional contract, which is basically I have a product, you bid on it, and made the best low responsive bid win. At this point in time, I think the CMGC is actually overstepping their bounds according to the administrative rules under administrative rules 137 and 125, because in both of those, and I think that's 137-049-0610, state it has to be at a substantial cost savings to the taxpayers to be even considered a CMGC process.
Thank you. And committee, I'm going to try to keep this moving because we have a lot of people to testify, so I don't want to disallow questions, but certainly Representative Matthews.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned about from $5 million to $15
million. Yes.
Does that seem adequate to you as well? Or
I believe, to me personally, because construction, you know, first and foremost, we have our checks and balances, which is insurance, bonding, et cetera. So majority of the GCs that actually do this kind of work, I believe it should be somewhere at least at 25 as a threshold, personally, because the amount of people that can get bonded for that $25 million in these complicated processes, or as I try to state, that only the select few can do these CMGC processes, they should be able to, you know, reach that one threshold.
Thank you. And you didn't mention the other bill, but I think Ms. Alexander sort of alluded to a Senate bill, and House Bill 3415, I think, is that very similar bill. And so that's the one that calls for audits of public contracts,
which should tie into Senate Bill 581, which actually creates a actually falls back to administrative rules and says, does this project meet the qualifications to be a CMGC? It's just an oversight, because that's what's happening, is that technically all these public contracting agencies, let's use Lane Community College as an example, just gave $53 million to Lisa Crutcher Lewis via a PowerPoint interview, and because they've already done work with these guys. I believe that Highland Construction could have done that project. I believe there's a whole mess of other Oregon contractors that could have done that project, but instead what we have is a relational contract. Instead of saying, hey, who's going to be the low responsive bidder, I use this as an example. Oregon State finally opened up a bid
Jerry, I was just trying to get out of you whether you support House Bill 3415.
I do support.
Okay, and because I need to move on with a lot more, because I'm sure you and I can talk about this for the rest of the meeting. So I appreciate your comments. And
would we turn this in? Because I actually have case studies that actually show now, because that was the biggest
problem. If you have documentation, you would turn it in to our assistant over there.
Okay. This is the documentation to show that there's actually case studies to say that in today's market, in today's recession, that we are actually spending way more money on an average on CMGC processes, and it does not meet the administrative rules according to Oregon state law.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So next up I have Sean Miller, Carl Redman, and Ken Dixon.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors. And we're supportive of the concepts within 3412 and 3415, and I just want to thank the co-chairs for hearing this issue today. Our organizations have been working for about the last 2.5 years to try to tackle the issues of construction manager, general contractor. You've heard the term CMGC a lot today. I want Todd just to take a minute to describe what that is. It's an alternative contracting method that's in the code, and just so you understand what that is, because you'll hear that term today, and we will committed to trying to fix this issue. And I want to just talk about some of the tenets that we would like to see in the bill just very briefly, Mr. Chair. And I think first we would, addressing the instances where CMGC is being abused or misused. In statute, it is used as an emergency, so you develop findings and go through the alternative contracting methods for that emergency. However, in the statute, it's an alternative method of contracting. It has become the norm. And so that's what we're trying to address today, is to get back to an alternative method and not the norm. And by doing that, we would like to see that the requirements must be relevant to the project. Sometimes there's requirements having experience with project values of $10 million or more when you're bidding on a $2 million project. Is that relevant? And we believe that the contracts to the contractors and the subcontractors should be more transparent. And so, I do want to support or express to the committee that we are supportive of this. We have some thoughts. 3415 is an issue. I know the chair has been working on an audit provision on the back end to make sure that they're following the public contracting code for CMGC. We're supportive of that, but we also would like to see something on the front end to make it sure that it's done correctly on the front end. I know that it's been expressed, Senate Bill 581 on the Senate side is a version that's trying to get on some of the issues on the front end, as well as I know 3412 with the trigger, the amount of the trigger to try to address some of those issues. We don't necessarily know if a dollar amount figure is the best way to go for 3412, because again, if it is a truly an emergency, it falls under that. There may be justification of why you should have CMGC. So again, we're supportive of that alternative method, but we want it to be an alternative and not the norm. And I will turn it over to Ken Dixon, Vice President of Todd Construction, and Carl Redman of Bear Electric. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Ken Dixon. I am the Vice President of Todd Construction in Tualatin, and I am testifying in favor of 3412 and 3415. And just to start out real briefly, you've heard the term CMGC. It stands for Construction Manager General Contractor. It's different than the traditional process for public works that you might be used to. And traditionally, an architect draws the plans. General contractors come and they bid on those plans, and it's generally open to anybody who can provide the bonding and the insurance necessary to do that. There's mechanisms in place to pre-qualify those to those general contractors. And so the lowest responsive bid would be the contractor who would get that project. Now, under this Construction Manager General Contractor, CMGC, it is an alternative procurement method for construction. The selection is made differently. The selection is made prior to the plans being drawn by the architect, and it's generally based on two things. Number one, it's based on a written proposal. And number two, it's based on some sort of a presentation or an interview. And based on those two things, the general contractor is selected. So it's not really based on price. There might be some fee comparison, but the fee is really the smallest thing when it comes to the price of a public improvement project. So, you know, kind of explaining a little bit what that CMGC is for, I had three brief points I'd just like to share with you in favor of 3412 and 3415. First is that the taxpayers really should get the most bang for their buck. And on average, CMGC costs 10 to 15% more than a standard lowest responsive bidder type of procurement. 10 to 15% more. How do we know that? There have been two studies done. Both of those have indicated that. I know my own experience, I've studied this significantly, indicates 10 to 15% greater cost when you use the CMGC process. Now, if you have even a $3 million school addition, a fairly small school addition, that 10 to 15% can get you four more classrooms. And so if you can build a, you know, the extra expense, it comes from the decreased price competition. It comes from the overhead layers required to run this complicated CMGC process. Taxpayers deserve to have their public improvements built at the lowest cost. Now, second, because the taxpayers, if they get the best bang for their buck, the entire construction community benefits. That's contractors, subcontractors, suppliers, and the craft workers. Imagine more construction for the same money. If you can build something 10 to 15% larger or better, that's 10 to 15% more hours you have where people can be working on that project, and that at no extra cost to the taxpayer. 10 to 15% more hours. The industry and the economy really deserve to be given the best opportunity to be working at peak performance levels, and the best way to do that is restricting these alternative procurement methods. Now, the third thing is the process really doesn't make sense, especially for the smaller projects under $5 million, and I would agree the number should be higher than $5 million, but it's just overly complicated. It favors contractors who have a marketing department, which isn't most of us. You know, they can put together a good proposal, they can put together a slick presentation, and it doesn't give the same price competition. You have one general contractor who will ultimately bid those plans. He might get 3 to 5 maybe bids for, say, electrical or mechanical work, whereas if you had 5 general contractors bidding, you're going to get 15 to 25 different bids. That price competition really makes a difference. So in conclusion, I guess I'd like to use an analogy. If we were here and Oregon wanted to send some sort of an athlete representative to, say, the Olympics, on the one hand, would we choose that representative, our best, based on them writing a proposal and doing a presentation for us? Or would we get the competitors together who are ready to be that best and just let them run or do whatever they do? And they would the best person would be based on the points scored or the fastest time rather than some sort of a proposal or presentation. I think we would prefer to let the best really be the best. And the only way you can do that is by comparing prices in construction or times and points if it's in athletics. So thank you very much for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you. Mr. Redman, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Carl Redman. I'm Vice President of Bear Electric, located in big town of Donald, Oregon. I won't repeat a lot of things that were already said because I share the same sentiments that Mr. Dixon just expressed, and I'm completely in support of 3412 and 3415. From a subcontractor perspective, my preference is for the design, bid, and build process, the competitive bid process. When we get to go that route, we get to make our pitch, make our best shot to every general contractor who is pursuing that same project. That gets more opportunities for us, and I also look at it from the standpoint of that stewardship role that our state government is providing for those taxpayer dollars, that we need to stretch each one of those dollars as far as it can go so we can put as many electricians working as possible. As was said, if we can add 4 more classrooms, if perhaps you can build another project, we have many infrastructure projects in need of repair or in need of work in this state, so more work would occur. 10 to 15% more hours could be spent on construction work in this state for every dollar that is spent through the design, bid, and build process as opposed to the construction manager process. It's economics, supply and demand. You know, the bigger supply of contractors we have trying to get that work is going to drive prices to the lowest possible point to be able to accomplish these projects. And I agree with the oversight committee approach. I think that's a fantastic way to do this, to make sure when we use those alternative methods, which do have their cases where they are necessary, but it gets overused when we call building libraries emergencies or straightforward projects, that it almost appears that it's the easy route to go for an agency to go the design or the CMGC process, just get somebody going on it. But what we have to do is make sure it's a level playing field, have the agency hire the architect, put the plans and specs together so everybody who's interested and able to perform that work has a shot at it. That's going to result in the best price and the best bang for the taxpayer dollar.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and sticking to the 3-minute almost mark. And we got a lot more people to testify. I think this is a big issue. I really appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Next up, we have John Rakowitz and Tom Girding. Good morning. Welcome, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, chairs, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. I'll try to be brief. I have an expert here with me, Tom Girding from our leadership, and I hope we'll be able to clarify, shed some light on, you know, an issue that we're not surprised that there's a great deal of interest and divergent opinion today. We have that within AGC. We've had robust discussions is the only way to describe it. I guess the main points I want to make is I'll start with why we do not support 3412 and why we do support 3415. 3412, its basic principle is a threshold, a dollar threshold, whether it's 5, 12, 15, 25, as been suggested today. The issues, and there are a lot of issues associated with alternative contracting in Oregon, and the use of that, or perhaps misuse, overuse of that, is not really about the amount, the dollar amount, regardless of the amount. It is rather about the proper legal use of alternative contracting and the type, and particularly the complexity of the type of projects. That's what it was envisioned to do. The basic contracting law, which is, as people have testified today, design, bid, build, that rewards the lowest cost, a responsive bidder, is what we also support. On the other hand, you do have reasonable and legitimate public policy benefits and reasons to have an alternative process. Tom will get into the particulars of that in a minute that we hope will help shed some light on what is really a complex issue. Given our concern in the industry within our own association. We believe the prudent step at this point is to look at the audit bill. Therefore, we support 3415 in a general concept. We have a couple of caveats that I'd like to express here quickly. And we certainly would like to be engaged if that bill is going to be considered for and perhaps the committee will be moving on that bill. The two concepts I'd like to add, respectively add, for the committee to consider is one, an advisory committee made up of both public agencies and contractors. The two parties that are involved in alternative contracting, the parties who put it out, and the parties who are involved in actually trying to build something and bid using that method. The other is, I think there's concern about the amount of money, 0.1%. I've heard some concern from public agencies in the hallways. We are not endorsing or supporting that particular amount. We're not interested in creating a gigantic fund here. What we're interested in is finding a source of funds that has no impact on the general fund that legitimately can pay for audits. And the reason we support 3415 is in the audit approach is we are without data. We are without facts. And we believe that there are enough questions out there that that work needs to get done. And with that, I'll happy to answer any questions after my board member here, Tom Girding, testifies. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Welcome. And if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Hey, Coach Hersholvey, isn't it? And members of the committee, my name is Tom Girding. I'm president and owner of T. Girding Construction Company. I'm based down in Corvallis. My firm is a commercial building contractor. We work throughout the state. Primarily, most of our business is in the mid-Willamette Valley. I'm, in addition, on the executive committee for the AGC Oregon Columbia chapter. As an owner of a public contracting company, I live this stuff every day, and I've been doing so for many years. My livelihood depends on this, and I would note that what I'm endeavoring to do here today, probably almost a little over 15 years ago, I was in the other side of the building in staunch opposition to the CMGC process. Today I'm here before you with a different position. Despite growing my business on the traditional design bid build delivery system, I strongly believe that the CMGC must remain an option to all public agencies should they have a project that is an appropriate application for this alternative delivery system. The original intent of CMGC was for emergency situations as well as highly complicated and complex projects where the contractor's early integration into the project team was imperative to the project's ability to make a tight budget and an aggressive schedule. I believe that same need exists today, whether the project is $3 million or $30 million. Unfortunately, there appears to be some owners who have inappropriately used CMGC for new construction, straightforward construction, expansions, some cases apparently even to select a contractor after the design was complete and in for a building permit. I wish to go on the record that the majority of such cases are not an appropriate use for CMGC. And I think most likely that's why we're here today, because of those inappropriate uses. To the contrary, if you would envision a rural school district with limited construction experience, they have a needs to expand a dated school and at the same time provide seismic upgrades within that building, maybe some remodel, a small addition, integrate a number of ADA requirements, add a complete fire sprinkler system, revamp the mechanical and electrical to energy upgrades, replace all the windows on the facility, and somehow do all this work while they remain in session with an occupied school. They need the option of utilizing CMGC. This is exactly the kind of project that the law exists to allow a public agency to have the flexibility to use this alternative contracting method for. not to mandate, but to allow them that opportunity. Having successfully completed similar projects for both school districts using both the design bid build and the CMGC, I'm here to assure you that the CMGC for these types of projects does save money. It does save money. By having the contractor involved early in the design, the project's design is monitored to stay within budget. Additionally, more cost-effective decisions are made in respect to materials and building systems. Quite often, existing products can be modified and used rather than replaced. The contractor generally provides much more in-depth discovery during the design process, which reduces unforeseen change orders during construction as well as saving on schedule. The projects are well detailed in regards to phasing and sequencing of the work, and those are built into the design documents as well. These are just a few of many cost-saving benefits that can result from the CMGC process. I believe I'm speaking for the majority of my peers in the industry by saying, if you engage the contractor early into the early planning of a project and make them a part of the team, you will see substantial cost benefits. We do this day in and day out for our private clients. It only makes sense to allow overall public to benefit from this process as well. In summary, I get why some of my peers are pushing back. They're not succeeding in getting CMGC work. Trust me when I say I get it. I just lost an award in my small hometown. I live in Philomath on a large high school renovation project. The reality is that the CMGC delivery system was the right choice for the project. I just lost it plain and simple. However, if House Bill 3415, a plug here for that, I think the audits will assure us that the CMGC is the right selection process. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony appreciate you taking your time out of it, and all the people that take their time out of their business to come here and give us their points of view on these on this issue. It does sound like it's a pretty complicated. So,
yes. Final comment I'd ask to make is, in the fall of 2007, there were over 105,000 construction jobs in the state of Oregon. Today, there's 67,000 jobs, roughly. That's a 35% drop. This industry's in collapse. We've taken at AGC a point of view, maybe it's a plea or a principle that we're trying to operate from, and that is, please do no further harm to this industry. We're very serious about that. It sounds a little, you know, jingo-like, but we believe that 3412 is risking doing further harm, and we don't see that it will necessarily get at the issue that we inside of AGC view as very legitimate. We have people all over the map. I think there are some members here testifying in a different way than we are, members of AGC. So we fully get that there's an issue. The question is, how do you get at the issue based upon facts and in a way that doesn't automatically change the entire possibility for public agencies and the benefits that are associated with the alternative use. So that'd be my final comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm sure we'll have continuing conversations on these issues. With that, up next, let's bring up Norm Malbum and John Mullis.
Good morning. My name is Norman Malbin. I'm general counsel for IBEW Local 48. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3412. The concept behind CMGCs is a good concept. If the agency can show that there will be substantial cost savings and there will not be favoritism, then the agency can exempt the project from competitive bidding. Unfortunately, so-called alternative bidding methods have now become so abused that some controls need be put in place. One is some oversight to make sure the CMGCs are used only when appropriate. Senate Bill 581 begins to address that. Another is to require that CMGCs cannot be used on small projects. This bill sets the threshold at $5 million. Local 48 supports this, but suggests that the threshold should be increased to $50 million. Most schools being built are not being built on an emergency basis, and they cost $20 to $30 million apiece. I often disagree with Sean Miller and ABC on many things, but on 3412, I agree wholeheartedly with Sean and Carl Redman and with Bear Electric, a non-union electrical contractor. He and I have been talking about this, and, you know, on both sides. When you get both of us agreeing, you know that there's some merit to it. In public works, my focus is on the worker and not on contractor. We need to remember that in public works, competition should be based on overhead, ramp-up, supply acquisition, efficiency of operation, and profit margin, and not on who can pay the cheapest wages. The use of CMGCs has created a different playing field. Alternative bidding methods have now become the norm and not the alternate. It's something that needs to be fixed. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. And I just wish to go on record that our council is in support of both of these bills. I'm not going to repeat the testimony that's been given by the people in front of me. I'll leave it up to the wisdom of the committee to set the proper dollar amount. I just want to go on record that we're in support of both the bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you getting under the 3 minutes there. That was really nice. So you can get me back on track. Thank you very much. Next up, I will call up Dan Bates and David Barenberg, perhaps, at the same time. Noting that you probably didn't come together, judging from your affiliations. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, chairs. I'm Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland, and I'm here to testify and express city's concerns with the two bills before you. First, just in terms of auditing of our contracting process, the City of Portland has an elected auditor, and currently on the list for their audits of this year are two that are on point, I think, with what you are driving at in the bill. First is one on looking at major capital construction process and auditing the current city processes and review rules and review processes, and provide a report on the progress of the city and capital construction goals, which have criteria such as minority, small business, employment, efficiency, on time, sustainability, and other components to the contracts, as well as cost effectiveness. Another audit that's being done this year is one to look at the experience from the purchaser side, and also how to look at holding contractors accountable for the terms of contracts. So for the bill, that one other point too, which is our dollar volume for contracts in a year is somewhere in the neighborhood, including our Urban Renewal Agency, the Portland Development Commission, puts our dollar volume in the neighborhood of $280 million. So under the bill as written, it would require a transfer of $280,000. At the same time where we have an elected auditor and our own internal process to try to ensure that we're following the rules and delivering effective and efficient projects. Second, in terms of CMGC and the threshold, most of our contracts are above $5 million, but some are below. And the times when we've used amounts that are below $5 million have been specialized. An example would be work on a park.
involving the contractor with the designer and some projects creates a more efficient project because sometimes the designer will call for things that are difficult to be done. We've had some slope issues in constructing slope in difficult circumstances and parks. Second issue, CMGC has been a tool for us to increase the participation of a diverse workforce in these projects. It's a better tool for working with the contracting community to establish goals and processes for involving a more diverse workforce. Much better done in building ongoing relationships and requirements and negotiations in that arena. So with that, I'd hopefully I'm under the three-minute limit, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, and it's probably a good segue for our next presenter. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Dan Bates with Thornwind Partners, representing the National Association of Minority Contractors of Oregon, and we have 65 contractors in Oregon, been around since 1969, and NAMAC Oregon would oppose 3412 as currently written, and that's because alternative bidding has become an important piece with our partner public contracting agencies in meeting some of their aspirational goals, as David alluded to, including women, minority-owned, and emerging small business participation in public contracting. That limit of $5 million, while many projects are above the $5 million, there are projects that come in below the $5 million. Many of our members would participate in those. In fact, those projects that are under $5 million allow for capacity building within our organization so that they can then grow and do some of the larger contracts. Thus, at this point, limiting to above $5 million actually hurts the members that are trying to grow and gain that experience, as well as meeting with our public contracting agencies some of those goals. Happy to engage in an ongoing discussion about alternative bidding. Certainly would support the notion that we need to make sure that these are following the current rules for CMGC, and happy to participate in that.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Mr. Barenberg, I was curious, since the City of Portland has an auditor that does audit public contracts, I'm curious if you could share some of the results of those audits, especially in terms of the CMGC process, but I'd be interested in seeing some of that and maybe talking with your auditor as well.
Happy to arrange that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Next up, Brian Smith, Mike Eliason, and Mark Landauer. Good morning, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be briefly speaking both in opposition of House Bill 3412 and House Bill 3415. With me is Brian Smith, Procurement Manager for Multnomah County. He'll speak a little bit more about 3412. Real quickly, I don't want to repeat previous testimony, but because this bill places 3412 places an arbitrary dollar limit on the use of design build or CMGC contracts, when the decisions on whether to use these procurement methods is generally based on the type of project and not the amount of the project, we believe public agencies are in the best position to determine which contracting method will result in the most effective and cost-efficient process. Real quickly, as an example, Marion County's local contracting rules identify both CMGC and design build as alternative procurement methods. Their governing body has to authorize the use of CMGC or design build by a board order, and it's project specific. They then issue a competitive RFP for the CMGC, and this is in Multnomah County as an example. Competitive RFP for CMGC or design build. They've used both of these in the past. They've used design build methodology on smaller steel buildings over the last couple of years. They have an RFP out right now for a small steel prefab building. And on the other hand, they use CMGC when there's a shortened time frame to get the work completed. They want to include the general contractor as part of the design team. Real quickly, we just believe that this is best left in the hands of the public agency to make the call. And we believe that the $5 million mark is probably not appropriate. Quickly on House Bill 3415, according to the most recent BOLI Public Improvement Project reports that we turn in for counties each year, this fee would cost counties roughly $200,000 each year, not including administrative costs, with the bill as written currently. On top of that, paying the fee would not even necessarily result in audits because the bill calls for a sort of random, undefined number of audits. Some counties already perform random audits on themselves, and I believe all counties and all public agencies, for that matter, already have contract auditing performed every year as part of their GAAP, or generally accepted accounting principles, rules. Many counties, for example, as part of their annual financial audit, also include a single audit on specific federal funding projects, and have also had grantors, both state and federal, conduct audits that look at procurement and expenditures for their grant funding. And again, for projects involving ODOT or federal money, there's also audits performed. Unless this bill is trying to uncover any other procurement or performance or financial compliance requirements that are not already addressed in the GAAP audits, the proposal seems a little bit redundant. So with that, I'll close on these two bills.
Good morning. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Brian Smith. I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. Co-chairs, representatives, thanks for this opportunity. I'm here testifying against House Bill 3412 for two primary reasons. One, I think it takes away the discretion of our local public contract review boards, which is set up in the statute as currently. And there's also another piece that's in this bill that I've not heard anybody speak to yet, but is a concern for both my jurisdiction and I know a lot of other local jurisdictions that use this, and that's the requirement to get three bidders or proposers beforehand prior to even making the decision to use the CMGC process. I wanted to provide some testimony here and bring my experience here as a purchasing manager for a local jurisdiction. At Multnomah County, I want to assure you that alternative bidding methods are in fact just that, alternative. Our construction projects are primarily done as bids. We bid them out. In the last 10 years, we've done exactly two CMGC processes. And I would echo the testimony that you've heard here today that it really should be an alternative. And I would push back the responsibility both on purchasing managers as well as on local public contract review boards to scrutinize findings that are brought before them. In fact, I've had a number of projects that have been brought to me as a purchasing manager, and folks have said, we think the CMGC is a good one for this. And working through that with them to really scrutinize that before it gets to a public body where there's public hearings, there's public testimony, and the decisions made by our local elected officials as to whether or not we would go forward with the CMGC process. That, to me, is where the decision-making authority should stand for this. Consequently, I'm opposed to any dollar level. It doesn't matter if it's $5 million or $20 million. I think any dollar level is inappropriate in terms of it takes away the decision-making authority from the local public contracting board. Again, it is an important tool. It's only appropriate for certain projects, not all projects. And I think that the issue of having three bidders proposed beforehand as well, in terms of the kinds of discussions that I would have with generally my facilities folks about, okay, which vendors are you going to select for those three quotes before you even decide you're going to have a CMGC process. That, to me, is the kind of thing that people are, that those who are in support of this bill have concerns about in terms of having an unlevel playing field. And because if I go to my facilities folks and I say, you need to get, you know, three bids, and they'll go to their, you know, three best friends kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing that we're really trying to avoid because that creates an unlevel playing field. these processes should be done in the open, and they really should be fair to all vendors. So I think at the very least you need to remove that particular provision of this bill, and if a version of this bill goes forward at all, I would respectfully ask that we have it applied just to state and not to local jurisdictions, because I don't believe we've got a problem.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 special districts throughout the state of Oregon. In the interest of brevity, just a couple points that have not been made thus far on House Bill 3412. SDAO does oppose the measure. There may be a case to revisit when it is appropriate to use these type of purchasing methods, but we do have a couple of concerns, some that have already been mentioned. The first is, in our belief, it is the type of project that ought to drive the type of method being used rather than a random dollar figure that is being proposed under the bill at this time. Another issue that hasn't been mentioned thus far is the implementation time for 3412. There may be some projects that are already in the pipeline under these construction methods, and this bill would become effective upon passage. On 3415, SDO also opposes this measure. Just to provide an example, there's no limitation on the amount of revenue this 0.1% will generate. Up in the metropolitan area, as you know, there is for example, a light rail construction project going on that's valued at about $1.5 billion. This fee will, of course, generate $1.5 million for this if this bill does become operative. The question that must be asked is, what are you trying to raise in order to gather what type of information? It's not clear. One other point I'd make on the fee is that there is, from what I can tell, no compelling state interest to charge local governments a 0.1% fee unless, of course, there is state money involved in the construction project. Local resources are very tight. They're very valuable. We try to spend them very appropriately, but at this time, I don't see the compelling state interest to charge small local governments 0.1% on every public works project, and I'll end my testimony at that point.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I sort of did have one question, perhaps. I suppose as you go through, and you mentioned that the local review boards do, you know, make these findings and trying to determine whether or not they're going to use a CMGC process. So, because I know the state statute requires certain findings, so do they go through and do an analysis and determine that the CMGC process will save your particular contracting agency money? Is that a criteria you look at?
Absolutely. The last one that I was part of, which was for our Selwood Bridge project,
mm-hmm.
There actually was a series of briefings for our board, as well as a fairly extensive analysis of the different contracting options and kind of the pros and cons for if we did this as a design bid build or if we did this as a CMGC. And so in that series of public meetings, we were able to have I think a fairly open discussion about what would be the pros and cons for using the CMGC. And it's not completely one-sided. I mean, there was a decision to make there,
mm-hmm.
And there was a very robust discussion that happened with our public contract review board. So I think the process worked very well there.
Well, that's good to hear, you know, but I do note from the, you know, some of the proponents of the bill that, you know, I have
heard of particular contracting agencies who do all their work through CMGC processes. And so they're making a determination every time that a CMGC process is going to save them money, and it just seems sort of unlikely that it would apply to all projects.
I would agree.
And so for a local contracting review board to make those kinds of decisions, and there is absolutely no recourse for public citizens to challenge that. And so, as to whether or not they're actually following the state law. So, though I appreciate local government's concerns about no state dollars being involved in their projects, so they shouldn't have to be accountable to the public, is a little bit of a stretch for me to take on.
Chair Holby, I'll address that because that came from my lips, of course. I'm certainly not suggesting that public agencies are not accountable. As the gentleman to my left mentioned, we do have public contracting review boards, which are, of course, accountable to the public. I did state, though, in my testimony that there may very well be a case that we need to review when it is appropriate to employ these type of contracting processes. And I think that the data is not there, or at least I have not been able to review it. So it is an open question, and obviously we need to drill into that further.
Great, great. Appreciate that and appreciate the willingness to drill into it. So with that, I am believe everybody that signed up got to testify. Certainly, please approach. 1 minute. I have a couple more bills that people are interested in hearing.
Thank you. I just want to mention that Robert...
And identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm sorry. Laura Alexander. I want to just mention for the record that Robert Gray Partners, Todd Construction, and Bear Construction, we all testified earlier in the beginning of this process and have extensive histories in hands-on public construction, project management, and are members of AGC. And as you can see, John Rakowitz and AGC's objectives and stances have not been representative of the majority of their dues-paying members. Thank you.
That sounds like an internal issue to me and not one appropriate for this body. But thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3412 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3415. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2631. Jan, would you give us a little description of House Bill 2631?
Chairs and committee members, House Bill 2631 allows a contracting agency to accept and consider an in-kind contribution from a bidder or proposer if the solicitation and the advertisement stated such contributions would be accepted and considered. But it prohibits a contracting agency from considering a monetary donation or an in-kind contribution in evaluating the responsiveness of a bid or a proposer or the responsibility of the bidder or the proposer. It prohibits a contracting agency from using a monetary donation or an in-kind contribution to offset, to reduce, or to modify a bid or a cost proposal, and it prohibits the contracting agency from using the monetary donation or in-kind contribution in determining which bid or proposal complies with the least cost policy. Defines the in-kind contribution, declares an emergency, effective on passage, and operative on January 1st, 2012.
Thank you. I have three people signed up to testify on this bill, Jerry Valencia, John Mullis, and Laura Alexander.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. My name is John Mullis, representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2631. It's important that public contracts are awarded in an open and objective fashion based on defined criteria. The public contracting process should be fair, open, objective, and transparent. Allowing in-kind donations by subcontractors muddies the water and could lead to increased rather than decreased costs for taxpayers. I'm a bricklayer by trade. I've never been a contractor, but if you can imagine a contractor saying that he would donate a truckload of brick to the project, 16 pallets of brick, and the material supplier manufacturer get those brick spec'd, you can imagine that the price of those brick might go up once they've got inside the door. And I'm not talking today about individuals donating money to their alma mater or their university of choice. That this bill has nothing to do with that, and I support that, obviously. So in closing, we just want to ensure that the public bidding process is fair, open, and transparent, and not influenced by in-kind donations. Projects should not be awarded on whether or not a potential recipient of a taxpayer-funded contract is willing to give a donation to influence the award of a project. Thanks. I'll do my best to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you.
Gary Valencia, Lowell, Oregon. Again, I support this same bill, too. I do not believe that in the contract documents should there be any line item to say, well, what will you give back, especially in a competitive market. I would not like to get a job at the University of Oregon because I wrestled there 1 year and I have enough money set aside that I can buy myself that job. At this point in time, I think it's fair to leave it open to all competitors that are out there for scope of work, and that's it, and should be left anything they want to donate later to the University of Oregon or to any other public contracting agency should be left to that individual, and it should not be tied into any possible work that's out there today or in the near future.
Thank you.
My name is Laura Alexander, and I support this bill. Allowing in-kind contributions and acceptance of any contract encourages underbidding and harms small contractors.
Thank you. Representative Smith, question?
Yeah, John, is this, give me the context. If we're not talking, so I heard maybe it is about university bidding and wanting to say, hey, if you're going to help build the, the new night court, giving us some free stuff, we can't consider that. That is part of the deal, and I heard you say, no, it's not. This is not related to that. Talk to me about the kind of scenario that's happening right now that this is getting after.
Chairs Holvey and Wisnett, Representative Smith, this isn't designed to prohibit individuals from donating to the university or the public agency of their choice. What this is trying to do is prohibit subcontractors from making in-kind donations to try and influence whether or not they receive a bid on a specific project.
I apologize. I didn't ask my question better. Give me the kind of scenario where this happens, garden variety example in nature out in the world where this happens, or even two or three, and why it's, I can understand the arguments about why it's good, why it's bad, but give me some examples.
Okay. Chairs Holvey and Wisnett, Representative Smith, there was an audit done on the UO Arena project. I believe that there was in-kind donations given by some of the subcontractors that did influence the award of bids on the project. I cannot speak specifically to them. If you'd like me to find concrete examples and get back to you with them, I'd be happy to do that. But I don't want to go on the record saying something that isn't true.
So I understand. So it is the university scenario, but what you're trying to say is, hey, if you still want to give, you can give. It just shouldn't be part of the contracting process.
Correct.
Okay. May I say something, Representative?
Ain't up to me.
Go ahead.
Lee Scratcher Lewis on their website, in their forms the subcontractors fill out, one of the forms does say, it says, how much, in regards to your donation, in-kind donation, how much are you willing to give? In addition to that, the blueprints that are found at Willamette Blueprints and several other places, which also have contracting documents on there from the higher GC, also say the same thing. And it's a form that the lower contractor downloads, he fills it out, and yes, on Lee Scratcher Lewis, it says on their form that it's asking for a donation back.
Interesting. Suppose you could get your hands on a form like that and supply it to this committee?
I've got several copies, yes.
Thank you. Appreciate that. No other questions. It sounds like an interesting process that we're talking about today, so I appreciate you coming forward and sharing your perspectives on these bills.
Thank you.
And on this one specifically. So, see no one else signed up to testify on House Bill 2631. Noting All in favor and no opposition so far. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2631 and open a hearing on House Bill 3000. And I hope we didn't shortchange the conversation on House Bill 3000 with the amount of time we have left. We can always pick the conversation back up if, in fact, we don't get through it. So with that, Representative Clem.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members of the committee, it's been nice to join you today. Brian Clem, for the record, I'm a representative from here in Salem District 21. And this bill, this is going to be the third time I've tried it. I have a new approach. Disregard everything that's in the bill. I've got new amendments that replace everything in there with something that I think might be more likable than the original concept that Sal Esquivel, Fred Gerard, myself, and David Edwards tried once, and then three of us tried it again, and that didn't work either. So the dash twos are what I'm speaking about, because the contraption I had set up in the original bill didn't work for anybody, really, apparently. So here's what we did last session in the Ag Committee originally, then it passed unanimously in the House and the Senate. For agricultural products, we said if an agency, state or local, that is buying food or agricultural products wants to give a preference to an Oregon farmer, they may. And it had been illegal to do that if it was more than 1 cent above some foreign farmer or some out-of-state farmer. So we said the agency may do that. And we said up to 10%. So if it's within 10% of the low bid, the contracting agency may buy local if they want to. If they go over 10%, then they have to put a written notice in finding why they do that. And the theory was, in case somebody was trying to steer business to their uncle or something like that, you'd have some paper trail. Though I will note that the one guy from the prison system who's absconded to somewhere in Europe right now, or maybe in the Middle East, I'm not sure, but Fred Monum, he did it all under the low bid system and ran off and threw his wife under the bus, and I think she's in jail and he's somewhere else with all the money. And that happened under the low bid system. So it can happen no matter what. So this bill takes what we did in the ag bill and basically takes the word ag out and applies it to all goods and services. Same concept. If that chair that I was just sitting in needs to be purchased by the legislature and the legislature wants to use an Oregon company, they may, even if it's a few bucks more than the Chinese import, they may buy that chair from the guy in Hillsboro who does it. I can't remember his name, but there is a person in Hillsboro who owns a company that makes chairs. Or ABC Commercial Furniture here in Salem does the legislative chairs, if I remember right. Or computers or consultants. And what you'll remember, the big one that was particularly noteworthy many years ago was the Oregon license plate contract was held by a company in, I think, Southeast Portland, and it got given to Canada. And that provoked an outrage, and there was an executive order to bring it back. I'm not even sure that technically was legal under the statute, because the statute said if it's cheaper, you can't do it. The current statute reads if they're equal, then you could give a preference to the Oregon bidder. And so you'll have somebody here from the governor's office in a minute. They've been looking into trying to steer some more volume to help, you know, government. It can't really create jobs when we have to buy something. We could at least try and buy from somebody who's paying taxes and headquartered, and their managers live here. There's a multiplier effect that occurs when you do that. It may not always make sense. I mean, that's going to be up to each agency as they're looking into things. But the fundamental question for us is, do we want the literal low bid system to be the only option anybody making purchasing decisions in the state has? Because that's pretty much currently the case. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions. This, what you'll see is only my name on the bill, but Senator Gerard and Representative Esquivel, and I think Representative Cannon are the other sponsors, but their names won't show until it gets reprinted. And they're not here because I didn't think to tell them, and I don't know if anybody else did.
Thank you, Representative Clem. I have one question. I note that your bill addresses 279A and B and no mention of 279C. So I'm wondering, do we, and 279C is the construction contracting, which is why I brought your bill up last, because it looks like it's aimed at not construction but other goods and services, but I'm not entirely sure it leaves construction alone. because 279A also applies some parts of it to 279C, and so I'd be looking for a clarification on that either, you know, at some point. I think it's something that you may want to take a look at and try to address if your intent is not to impact 279C.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we had had that conversation. The intent is to not deal with construction at all in this, and if 21, 22, and 23, where it notwithstands 279C, doesn't cover it all because it's in a few other places, then we can certainly amend it to find other places. And I think somebody in the audience has brought that to my attention, and they're helping me draft amendments that also, and I think DAS actually has some amendments that I also think are good. Applying the agricultural wording to all products sometimes it ends up creating a weird deal. Like if it says transported within the state and it's a consultant, well, of course they're transporting themselves around within the state, so that doesn't make any sense. So there's some amendments coming, and I think one of them covers the rest of what you're talking about, but if not, we can certainly make sure of it.
Because it's not. Yeah, I don't know for sure. I just thought we could seek a clarification on that and make sure we're not having a negative impact.
Oh, there he is.
So.
And the Scott Nelson is also here to talk about it, and I can go back to my seat whenever you want me to.
Question. Representative Smith, question?
Yeah, thanks, Brian, bringing it. You know, great concept. I think the answer to my question, is about interstate commerce and constitutionality. My impression, knee-jerk, sort of dumb kid's hunch, is that this is fine. It's not a penalty. It's a reward. It's just fine. If there's if we have chapter and verse on that, it would be mildly helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when the first bill came up in the ag arena, we went to look into this, and the AG at the time, actually both the former AG and the current AG have both told me the same thing. When we are purchasing goods with our money as government, we're allowed to preference it however we want. There's no interstate commerce issues. If we try to tell other people what they can and can't buy or they have to buy local, that's where you get into problems. But the reciprocity triggers can be triggered by setting state preferences. And that's another reason to leave it optional for the agencies so they understand the reciprocity issues, meaning if we have a bidder or a company that makes one particular thing and they mostly sell to state governments, we probably wouldn't want to preference that particular thing because that would potentially trigger automatic 10% penalties on them wherever they're at around the country. So it's often helpful to not have this be a blanket one-size-fits-all thing, but have the option to do it and then have, you know, the executive branch largely, when they're through agencies doing purchasing, figure out, would this trigger reciprocity? Would that be a problem? And certainly let the legislative branch, when we're buying stuff, you know, like these things, figure out whether there's an Oregon company that could make this and it wouldn't hurt their businesses around the country to do it.
Thanks. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to, unless there's no other questions, then I don't see, I want to get a couple other people up to testify. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Real quick, I'm going to bring up Mark Landauer and Scott Nelson. And note, I did say real quick, but I do want to hear your thoughts, and we may come back and visit this bill again. So, as with all the bills today.
Great, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm Scott Nelson. I'm the Jobs and Economy Advisor for the Governor, I want to be here today to be supportive of the bill. A year ago, or more than a year ago, we sat down with some economists at the University of Oregon and tried to map out a comprehensive and integrated economic development strategy. And it was quickly decided by others that I should keep that strategy in my own head as we design things, but not try to explain it because people would get all sorts of tripped up and we'd be falling all over ourselves. Nonetheless, I still stand by the ideas embedded in that. The two of the key steps were in growing our own homegrown traded sector businesses. So getting to a point where, in fact, we were bringing new capital into the state, but basing that on businesses that we are actually growing here and getting all the benefits of the job growth from. And part of that, in turn, the fundamental basis for that was ensuring that we were maximizing the money multipliers of our in-state supply chains and processes. And it seems to me that if we're trying to maximize that, not only that multiplier, but also make sure that we are benefiting from the generated revenue, that there's no better way to start than to use the revenue that we already have in supporting Oregon businesses. So that's the very brief version. I know that Representative Smith went to what he refers to as UVA on the Charles. I actually went to the UVA on the Rivanna, and I can tell you, remembering all the way back, that in this case, the state is acting as a market participant and not a market regulator. So thereby, it I believe it passes constitutional muster. Want to be supportive of the concept, and happy to take questions or hear from others.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Landauer, are you to identify yourself for the record?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. First of all, I'd just like to thank Representative Clem. He addressed many of the issues that we've raised with him regarding the bill. I think that the cross-reference on line 7 of the first page, 279A055, does have an impact on 279C, and we've made a suggestion that that be stricken, and he also mentioned the transportation issue with regard to personal services. So he's largely covered my testimony. So with that, I'd be happy to end and take any questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you very much for that quick testimony. Appreciate it. Appreciate you both coming forward. Looks like a fascinating bill that we're probably going to talk about again. I also have Joe Esmond up to speak to this bill. And actually, Laura Alexander and Jerry Valencia were signed up, but I think they have now left, realizing that the amendments excluded or were intended to exclude contracting, perhaps. And I have Marcy Stone as well. Almost forgot you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
As fast as I can. Good morning. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm a business agent for the IBEW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. I want to go on record in support of this bill because this is what we're talking about. Small businesses in Oregon get a little more piece of the pie. Small businesses are the backbone of the economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Marcy, I'm sorry that I bring you up last, but identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Representative Holby and Representative Wisnett and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcy Stone, and I'm with the State Procurement Office with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to make this very brief in terms of that we, too, are in favor of this bill and supportive of the bill. We have identified that the bill is the -2 amendment is an expands the existing preference for agricultural products. We would like to make three suggestions in terms of this bill. The first one is the clarification of goods and services. We would suggest that instead of produce, because this is very ambiguous and very hard to define, to change that for goods to be processed or fabricated within the state of Oregon, and for services to be performed within the state of Oregon. We have provided in our testimony some suggested language that might help guide some direction around these changes. The second comment that we would like to make is that around the flexibility and the percentage in the solicitation. We appreciate that flexibility in the bill. Each agency now has the opportunity to decide the cost allowance up to 10%, and this would help in the decision-making around the solicitation. However, this does create potentially some confusion around the reciprocity and among potential bidders, but we welcome that challenge, and we would work with that as time goes on. The third area is that we have added to our testimony, at the bottom of the testimony, is the current preferences within the state of Oregon. And those are including the approved agricultural preference, and that's just for your information. And I would be happy to take any questions at this time.
Thank you so much for your testimony, your suggestions, and I'm sure Representative Clem's paying attention to them, as well as the committee as well. So appreciate both your inputs and look forward to doing a little more work on this. Thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3000 and adjourn the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.
Eugene. Thank you for the impression.